Hello and welcome. It's my pleasure to welcome listeners on behalf of the iThrive Consortium, the Clinical and Translational Science Award lodged at the University of Virginia, Virginia Tech Carilion, and Inova Health System. As part of the CTSA Award, we're producing a series of podcasts intended to promote sound and rigorous clinical research at the iThrive partner institutions and beyond. I am your host for this podcast, Dr. Jim Nataro, and I serve as the Benjamin Armistead Shepherd Professor and Chair of Pediatrics at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. I'm also an investigator in the field of global health. I'm joined by Brian Nosek, PhD, co-founder and executive director of the Center for Open Science, or the COS, that operates the Open Science Framework, the OSF. And this is a collaborative management service for registering studies and archiving and sharing research materials and data. Brian is also a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Virginia. He received his PhD from Yale University in 2002. He co-founded Project Implicit, a multi-university collaboration for research and education investigating implicit cognition, that is, thoughts and feelings that occur outside of awareness or control. Brian investigates the gap between values and practices, such as when behavior is influenced by factors other than one's intentions and goals. In 2015, Brian was named one of Nature's 10 and to the Chronicle for Higher Education Influence List. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by Dr. Joseph Michaleski. He's Associate Professor of Public Health Sciences at the University of Virginia, where he's also Assistant Director of Genetics and Bioinformatics at the Center for Public Health Genomics. He's also Assistant Dean of Biomedical Data Sciences Research for the UVA School of Medicine. Joe's personal research interests are in the genetics and genomics of complex diseases, especially cardiovascular diseases and complications of diabetes. As a School of Medicine Assistant Research Dean, he oversees planning and development of computational and data science related resources, and he advocates for computational research in the Dean's office. He advises and participates in informatics development for iThrive. He has authored or co-authored more than 150 publications and has served on NIH and foundation advisory boards and panels. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks very much, Jim.
So first, Brian, let's start with you. So please, what exactly is open science and why is this important to the scientific community?
Open science is how we imagine science to be rather than how it is at present. Open science is about promoting transparency, sharing, and inclusion at all parts of the research life cycle. So that includes the process of conducting research, design, planning, conducting. It includes the contents that are produced in research, the data that are generated, the code that's generated, the materials that are the basis of collecting the data. It includes the outcomes of research, the findings that I get, the reports that I write of my research, and it includes the evaluation of that research, peer review, and all of the discussion and tangling and wrestling with the implications, the meaning, the interpretation of the findings that we produce.
Okay, so clearly that's a lot. So why is that important to the scientific community? Why is that a step forward from where we currently sit?
Yeah, well, what we idealize in science is that it is a social enterprise to try to figure out something about how nature operates. And as a social enterprise, for you to be able to evaluate the quality and meaning of my research, you need to be able to see how it is I got to the claims that I arrived at. It is not a trust me enterprise where I just say, no, this is what I found. Trust me, this is what it is. Rather, it is an enterprise where I make some claims and I show you the basis of those claims. Here's the methodology that I generated. Here's the data that came out. Here's the analysis process that I applied to it. And you, as an observer, get to critique, evaluate, extend, challenge, reinterpret, reanalyze, whatever you want to do with the basis of that evidence so that we can assess its robustness, its credibility, and extend it and build on it as we imagine science to accumulate. So we have these ideals of science is cumulative, right? We collect evidence and build explanation, challenge those explanations, and remove uncertainty of how we understand things. And we imagine that science is self-correcting, that by this critique process, by an unfettered exchange of ideas and evidence, that we will root out the bad ones and ultimately arrive at compelling evidence-based interpretations that we can use in application and otherwise. So mm-hmm. when that's described, most people say, yeah, isn't that how science operates?
Right.
That's just what science is. I went through my fourth grade class and learned about that. But of course, when we see science in reality, we recognize that it isn't quite living up to that. So it's open science really is science idealized rather than what science is presently in practice.
Yeah, so maybe I would call it utopian. So, as I introduced myself, I'm an investigator, but my field has not realized that maybe utopian view. I think we still have many investigators who play everything very close to the vest. They're afraid of getting scooped. They may not even be entirely willing to. I don't know. I'm sure there are some who are a little bit reticent about sharing their data because of what other people might do with their data and how they might interpret it. But Joe, you belong to a scientific community where open science seems to be working at least a little better than in my community of investigators. Maybe tell us a little bit about how it operates and what open science looks like in your research community, please.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be glad to. Brian gave a almost philosophical and very impassioned high level view of what open science is. And I mean, that's the ideal. But from the point of view of researchers in the trenches, I think about open science as he said, open methods, open data, and perhaps open publishing as well. And these three areas come together and in a grand vision, the vision that Brian articulated, but individually, these areas, perhaps with the exception of the open publishing, although we do have choices in where we publish. So in a sense, we can influence that part of the process, but certainly from the point of view of open methods, open data, and let's say also open biospecimens or open perhaps cell lines or stem cell lines that we've generated, that we can share those with the community. So from a pragmatical standpoint, we've got these individual areas. So the protocol development, the method development, talking about how we did our analyses, sharing data, and then where we're publishing. So it's true that I work in genomics, and genomics has been at the forefront of data sharing in biomedical research. And I mean, that's been driven, just thinking historically, that was driven primarily by just cost at the beginning. So the very first NIH policy on genomic data sharing was actually geared towards what are called genome-wide association studies. And that was back in around the 2006 era. And the idea then was that we're gathering these huge data sets of genetic association results. We need somewhere to share them. We need a repository where we can put these in, and we need some principles around getting maximum use out of this. So NIH was funding these studies that cost an enormous amount of money, and that they wanted to maximize reuse of this data. So in genomics, we've been working under this expectation that you're going to share data for about 15 years now. And the latest draft, the latest implemented genome data sharing plan was in around 2014, 2015, where again, you had to demonstrate in your research plan that you were going to share this data, and the community would be able to extract reuse out of this. I think where the genomics community isn't so far along is sort of the the open methods and perhaps open protocol part of this. The community would say, we've got these massive resources of data, and you know, a lot of the time we're doing discovery. You know, we're not focusing on one specific hypothesis. And so perhaps we give ourselves a more of a free pass on that because, you know, we're resource generation, we're doing discovery. You know, that's very different to the investigator who's running a clinical trial and says, I've got this very specific hypothesis, this very specific intervention I need to test. And so I think the genomics community hasn't done quite as well, perhaps on the methods and the protocol side of things. But that's changing as well in response to external pressures that I'm sure we'll talk about.
So I think both of you have convinced me that open science is in the best interest of the general community, not necessarily the scientific community, but the public, right? And ultimately we're in science to benefit the public, not to benefit the investigators, right? And so if they're NIH grants or they're funded by tax dollars, clearly we as scientists wish to benefit. I mean, those communities deserve, right, the maximum benefit from their tax dollars they're investing in. If you're a foundation, it's the same way, right? So the foundation doesn't exist to benefit the scientists. Foundation exists to benefit some other community. So I'm buying it, if you will, that these practices are in the best interest of the public. So clearly it is a direction that we should be going. But as an individual investigator, and I've been, you know, doing this for three decades, you know, I have to say I remain a little bit, shall we say, reserved. So if there are individual investigators who still have some reservations, Brian, what's in it for that individual scientist? You know, if the NIH says you have to do it, then we're going to do it. But is there a value proposition for an individual scientist to embrace these methods?
Well, that's a good question. And an important conceptual point is that one can embrace incrementalism with open science. It isn't all or none. It is, I can take steps over time to increase the transparency, sharing, and inclusion in my research. But there are some specific benefits that researchers that move down this path towards greater openness realize. The first is that you get to live your values. There are very few scientists who are against transparency. Say, no, I just want everything for myself. Now, researchers get into science because they have a broader mission for the public good. And the reality constraints of doing the science, of how people are rewarded for their science, is what ends up creating senses like a feeling of ownership over this data or needing to be private because of the rewards. I need my publications in order to get my advancement. So there is just the basic of, oh, this is how I thought science should be. But there are some more practical value propositions as well. Researchers that practice more openly get more engagement with their work. They get more credit for different types of scholarly contributions. One of the most important parts of the open science movement is to expand the sense of what is a scholarly contribution from the singular, get your name on the paper, ideally first or last, but at least on the paper, to it's not just about the paper. The data is a scholarly contribution. The code you generate can be a scholarly contribution. The materials, the reagents, all of these things are themselves scholarly contributions that should be credited as such. And so by sharing those, one can start to, for example, accumulate citations of the data that they share and credit for having generated useful data. Like associated with that is that greater transparency and sharing is associated with more impact. For example, people who do preprints, sharing their papers early to accelerate the dissemination of that and gather feedback as things go through the publication process, tend to have more citations than people who don't share preprints. causal inferences are challenging there, but there's an easy association of greater accessibility of papers, makes it easier for people to find, discover, and then use and cite that work. Likewise, there is some evidence that researchers who practice more openly end up getting more collaborations. There's a common concern of, oh, if I share my stuff, then I will lose getting opportunities to get credit. But in fact, it seems that often the opposite happens. So for example, you mentioned in the intro that my substantive area is implicit bias. We created this website when I was in grad school called Project Implicit, where people can go and measure their implicit biases for a variety of topics, age, race, gender, et cetera. Millions of people now come to that website each year, and we generate tons and tons and tons of data about implicit bias, more than we could possibly analyze ourselves. We adopted a practice of just making that data available on the OSF as each year as the new round of data gets collected. And we have gained in publications and collaboration opportunities far beyond what we have lost, because people ask us, oh, we have this idea for how to use it. You're the experts with that data. Maybe we can collaborate on X, Y, and Z. And there are people that do things totally independently. But it's much more enriching to make things available if those things could be of use to others. And then the final thing sort of may give rise to some interests in the risks of sharing. And that is that one, by sharing openly, by being transparent in how it is I got to my claims, the claims that I got, the data, the code, and everything else, it increases rigor because it makes it easier to detect error. You can interrogate what it is I did, and if you find something wrong with it, then we're more likely to actually get it corrected. Whereas if you only see the paper at the end, you can't, and I can't, identify the errors in my work. Now, the risk there, obviously, is ego. I don't want you to find out all of those things I messed up. But we know, we all know science is super hard. We all know that there's errors in what we do all the time. So if we are willing to accept that intellectual humility of really what we're here to do is figure out where we've got things wrong, then the ultimate impact is that you identifying those errors for me should be met with gratitude. Oh, thank you. Now I have a better understanding of what I'm studying and more confidence in it than I had before without any other eyes being on it.
So Joe, is that the... is that the situation that's prevailing in your community among investigators who are using it? Are they seeing those benefits as Brian's articulating?
Yeah, I think generally that's true. I think that being open, sharing your data, sharing your protocols leads, as Brian said, to greater visibility and pragmatically greater number of citations. That's been shown. So you're going to generate new citations this way. And as he said, there's the possibility of generating new collaborations. It's, you know, this idea that another group is going to take your experiment and reanalyze it from scratch, I think it depends, of course, on the data and the complexity of the experiment. But with many of the protocols and the experiments we're doing and the analyses we need to do on the data, I think it's a little bit overblown to be as paranoid as we are about being scooped. I mean, I think that we are so awash in data now. I mean, in the early days of genomics, when we had to start putting our data into dbGaP, this was sort of in the 2009, 2010, when really dbGaP was becoming, should say that for people that don't do genetics or genomics research, this is an NIH-funded repository where studies of a certain size and complexity have to be deposited there. And actually, more and more studies are going to be required to be deposited there. So there was concern that you had to place your data there, and completely unaffiliated investigators from all over the world could apply to get access to the data and could get the individual level data set and analyze it. So there was a lot of just concern and real sort of angst about this at the beginning. of course, it turned out that all of those concerns were really overblown. The number of situations where an independent investigator has gotten the data and done something, you know, that the study might otherwise have published, they're minuscule in terms of the number of instances of this. And I think sort of talking to your point, your concerns, you know, you think about the studies that you might be doing, and again, the complexity of the protocols and how you're generating the data. Pragmatically, how would somebody actually go about writing a paper based on that, even if they had the data, to actually submit to a journal of repute and actually do justice to that? You could. There are many avenues, I think, for you to refute that and for you to, you know, if somebody were trying to do that with your data. But I think that there's just an over sort of fear about being scooped that, you know, I don't think is there, it's really there in practice. I think the other aspect though is that just in terms of being open doesn't mean that you have to give your data out immediately as soon as you've generated it. I mean, I think that scientists generally support, if you want to call it an embargo period, or at least some period where they had to construct the experiment, they had to get the money, the funding, and they had to execute the experiment. And so I think that they feel, and rightly so, that there should be a period when they have exclusive access to that data and to sort of publish it and to get recognition for it. We're not saying that you have to, you know, do away with that part of the scientific process. But what we're saying is that after that, you know, then you should find ways and should be incented to share your data and make it more widely available for kind of many of the reasons, all of the reasons that Brian mentioned. So you and I, as sort of crusty old investigators, if you like, you know, we should be thinking along these lines because of the benefits we will accrue from it. And that I think we should be less fearful about being scooped generally.
All right, so you've convinced me that open science is in the best interest of the public, of the funder, and probably even the individual investigators. So it sounds like we should be pushing the boulder down the hill, and that there would be a very rapid revolution in all scientific communities towards open science. And maybe the resistance is, and you know, maybe it's people like me who aren't, you know, are sort of old and crusty, as Joe suggests, and we're clinging to old-fashioned ideals. But how do we do this? How do we engineer? How do we evolve to more open scientific community generally? I think both of you guys are involved in that. But Joe, why don't you take the first stab at that one?
So I would divide the investigator community into you know, the young investigators and perhaps the established investigators, and I think that there's going to be a harder, I think we're acknowledging that there's going to be a harder sell, and there's going to be a heavier lift to get established investigators who don't have this fabric of openness in their labs and their research groups to adopt these things. Certainly not overnight, and perhaps, you know, as quickly as we might hope. I think we definitely need to be working with the young investigators, explaining these value propositions to them, you know, articulating the benefits, and then giving them training in and resources so that they know, you know, what they should be sharing, the places where they can be sharing it, and, you know, and actually building up expertise in their, encouraging them to build up expertise in their labs, both procedural and I think technical, so that this isn't an onerous after the fact kind of part of their research program, but it's integrated, you know, all the way through from the inception of a study, where sharing is just part of the design. It's not something that you add as an afterthought. That it truly is part of the overall project, that expectation. And then I think just, again, you know, articulating the benefits that for their career, as well as, you know, the reputational benefits that they will get, which is both tangible and intangible. I think that reputation can actually be pretty important in for example, in grant reviews, so that you only have, you know, your 12 pages or so in your research strategy, and you can only put so much information into that. You can't dot every single I and cross every single T. So some of the evaluation of your grants is going to be against your ability to execute the project, you know, as a lab and as a researcher. And that reputation is key, I think, and can be helpful in terms of getting grants funded. So I think there's multiple areas in training young investigators where we can bring this to the fore, and that we can encourage and we can demonstrate how to do it. And I think these are training opportunities that can be didactic in format, as well as with mentoring and with opportunities like this, you know, reinforcing it through the iThrive program and other programs. I think established investigators, that's a different story. And I think that I would ask you the question, what would it take to get you to sort of buy into this and to adopt it as part of your research lab? I mean, you do research you've worked on the microbiome, and you've had, you know, large data sets where, you know, presumably you've had to come up against some of this, but you also do presumably, I don't know if you've done trials research, but epidemiological research in your pediatric research. So what would it take you to sort of buy into these ideas and to adopt them wholesale?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that discussions like this are what it takes for me. I think, you know, at the institutional level, you know, as you know, I'm a department chair, and so having chairs and associate deans and deans, you know, promotion and tenure committees, having them buy in, and value that as part of evaluating the success of a scientist, and, you know, promotion and tenure decisions, that sort of thing is important. You know, clearly Brian has provided a lot of resources for the scientific community. So maybe I'll hand it off to Brian and what else and what other obstacles do we need to be working on in this area, Brian?
Yeah, I agree with everything that Joe said, and I want to extend one of the points that he made, which is the burden, right? It can feel like, oh my gosh, this sounds like a whole lot of extra work. Oh, this open science stuff. I'm already busy. How can I append this on to my workflow? But what he pointed at was, if you plan for openness, you can actually integrate it into the workflows that you have. And there are even opportunities to make oneself more efficient rather than less. The challenge that we started with when we got into trying to build tools to help promote openness was thinking, how do we help labs solve a problem that they have today for their own work? And so this is the basis of the Open Science Framework you mentioned, which is our free service for researchers to manage their life cycle and then make it available to anyone if they wish. So the problem that we started with to solve was, me as a PI in my lab lose access to the data and experiments that we do in the lab all the time, right? Computers blow up, postdocs blow up, people leave, right? There's all sorts of dynamism and change of what's happening in a laboratory and with collaborations. It's hard to keep track. And so where our own work is inefficient because we don't have openness within our own teams in a way that we can sustain. So one of the opportunities with planning for openness is that you improve your documentation and data management practices within the lab so that, for example, you can always access within a shared environment all of the studies and all of the experiments and all of the data that you ever done internally. And that can all be private. And one of the things that we did with the OSF was we provide that private environment and then make it trivial for you, if you want at some point, to make some or all of that publicly accessible with a click, right? It says, make public. You click it, it says, are you sure you want to make this public? And you say, yes, ready for that to be public. Right, so the action of openness then is a trivial action that is conducted after you've now improved your process internally of managing your data and materials and work for your own team's purposes. So that I think is an important part. And then the other part I think is just referring back to the earlier conversation, which is really embracing incrementalism. It's hard to think, okay, now I'm gonna do open science and think, okay, now I'm gonna do all of these things. The easier way to start is to say, I'm gonna try sharing a preprint. I've never done that before. Our next paper, let's post it on our preprint service. And then it is a gateway drug. It's like, oh, that went pretty well. That was easy. All right, maybe I'll try sharing a data set. We have this, the most recent publication. It comes from this very large data collection we have. I'll share just the portion of data that's required to reproduce the findings in that paper. That won't be so hard. Share that. Oh, that went great. How awesome. Right? So these things tend to accumulate with experience and get integrated, as Joe was indicating, into the daily workflow of how the lab operates. So that just becomes natural, even beneficial.
Great. So I think we've talked about some of your resources, Brian. We're going to make those available as links when we post this podcast on the iThrive website. I hope that that individuals who either are not very familiar with open science principles or know a little bit about it have learned some things today, and they their interest will be piqued enough to visit your websites. I want to thank both of you for spending time with us today, and of course thank the listeners. So thank you, everybody. And we hope that, and I actually look forward to practicing some of the things that we talked about today.
Great. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks.